Well, my name is Charlie Farman, and I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic.
Oh, how are you?
By the grace of God and the help of the AA program, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink today. Well, since October 29th, 1969, one day at a time, and for this I'm very grateful. I don't want to give anybody the impression that Joe and I think that we're gurus on the big book. I heard Joe make a talk several years ago on the big book, and I'd been pretty well interested in it myself and had found some things that I wanted to discuss with somebody. And I had the opportunity to talk with Joe and discuss these things with him, and this was this meeting that Joe H. over here was talking about at the Camelot Inn, and we found that we had a mutual interest in the big book. We felt that the big book has been written in a certain sequence for a certain purpose. We don't think that the chapters are thrown in a haphazard manner. We feel that the thing follows in a certain sequence to bring forth certain ideas. And as we began to talk about the big book, we found that there was a lot of people interested in discussing the book and learning what they could about it. And Joe and I are here for only one reason, really, to interest people in the study of the big book. We feel that this is where the answer lies for we alcoholics. And we feel that if we get into the book and we study it, there's a wealth of information contained that we miss if we don't study the book. Joe, you want to say a few words before we start on the preface?
My name is Joe. I'm definitely an alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
And it's through these beautiful 12 steps of this program and this fabulous book, some great people in Alcoholics Anonymous, from a guy that I found in this fellowship. It hasn't been necessary for me to take a drink since March 10th, 1962. For this, I'm extremely grateful. It's good to be here tonight, and it's good to see so many people interested in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I, too, after some years of sobriety, opened the book and began to study. And it was through meeting Charlie that I discovered another person that was interested in the great challenge of unlocking this book to us. And we became involved in this, and it's been a great, great part of my life. As Charlie says, we don't say that what we say is law. We're just sharing our ideas of this fabulous book, and this is what it's all about here tonight. And you let Charlie get these things going, and this is very informal, and I was glad to notice that so many people bought the books. I think it would be a great idea as to follow us as we go along. And if you got a pencil in your pocket and you'd like to make some notes in your book, I know mine's full of scratches and all kind of marks, and they all have little different meanings. And I can translate them later on. Maybe you'll be able to translate yours later on, and it'll help you in some, if we can do no more than give you a study design. Charlie?
Back in probably the years of 1938, 1939, the first 100 people in AA were faced with a decision as to how they were going to answer all the inquiries that were flowing into their small office in New York from all over the United States. As most of you probably know, the first beginnings of AA was in the northeastern part of the country, in Akron, Ohio, Cleveland, Ohio, New York City, so on and so forth. Due to some publicity that had been put out, inquiries began to flow into, the office that they had in New York City from all points of the United States, from places like Texas and places like Oklahoma and California and Washington, etc. And these people who started this program were faced with a dilemma. They didn't know how they were going to get the word out and get the message out to these people who were sending these inquiries in from all over the United States. And they knew that the best way to do this was on a face-to-face basis, on a face-to-face confrontation. being able to talk with the suffering alcoholic and identify with him, and so on and so forth. But they also knew with their limited numbers that they had at that time, and the fact that most of them were located in the northeastern part of the United States, that it would be impossible for them to see these people on a face-to-face basis. And there was a decision made to see if they could carry the message of alcoholism and recovery from alcoholism by the printed word as well as by word of mouth. And they decided that they would make a book or write a book, produce a book, and this book that they were going to produce was supposed to do three things. This book was supposed to first identify the problem of alcoholism. And after it identified the problem of alcoholism, it was to also give a solution to the problem of alcoholism. And after it gave the solution to the problem of alcoholism, it was also supposed to tell the alcoholic how to find the solution. And I think we need to remember, as we talk about the big book and as we discuss it and as we go through it, the big book was written primarily to take the place of the face-to-face confrontation, to carry the message through the printed word, and it was to do three jobs: identify the problem, identify the solution to the problem, and then tell the alcoholic how to find the solution. And we always like to start with the big book right back in the very beginning of it, and I think we find a word or two that is very important for us to understand in the preface to the book. So those of you that have the book with you, let's pop her open to the preface and we'll look at it here just a little bit. My particular book that I have is a second edition, which was printed in 1955. My book says that this is the second edition of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, which made its first appearance in April of 1939. More than 300,000 copies of the first edition are now in circulation. Because this book has become the basic text for our society, and has helped such large numbers of alcoholic men and women to recovery, there exists a sentiment against any radical changes being made in it. Now, I think we have a word contained in that second paragraph that we need to look at, and it is the word text. We find that there are a lot of different types of books, but most books you can put into two categories. You can put them in the category of being a novel, or you can put them in a category of being a textbook or some other categories, but let's talk about the novel and the textbook. A novel is a book that we read, or it may be something like Gone with the Wind, or it might be Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farms, or it could be almost anything. And we take a novel and we read it, and if it was written by a good author, we will enjoy the novel, we will find it quite exciting. Usually at the end of the book, it will end up something to the effect that they lived happily ever after. And we enjoyed the book, and we get through with it, and we say, "My, that was a fine book," and we put it up on the bookshelf. Now, chances are we will probably never read that novel again. Oh, we may someday, if it's a cold, wet, dreary, rainy day, and we've got nothing to do, and we're looking for something to read, we might possibly see that novel on the shelf, and we may say, "Well, that was a good book. I believe I'll read it again," and we'll take it down and read it one more time. The chances are we'll never read it more than twice. A textbook is something different. A textbook, the very word text, the very meaning of the word text in our society today, and has been for many, many years, is that a textbook is something that you use to teach with. And we find that a textbook, in order to be understood, must be studied. And it must always be started at the beginning of the book. As an example, if I had a textbook based on mathematics, and I would take somebody in this room, perhaps Joe, and let's say Joe didn't know anything about mathematics at all. He doesn't know how to add, and he doesn't know how to subtract, and he really doesn't know numbers very well. He can hardly count to 10 even. And I get this textbook on mathematics, and let's say that chapter 5 of this textbook that I have dealing with mathematics deals with algebra. And I take this book and I hand it to Joe and I say, "Now, Joe, there's some problems in this book in chapter 5, and I want you to go to chapter 5 and work these problems out and then show me your answers." Now, remember, Joe can't even add and subtract. Joe can just barely count to 10. He knows nothing at all about mathematics. And I hand him a textbook and turn him to chapter 5 to do algebra problems, and chances are Joe's not going to know a damn thing about what he finds in chapter 5. We feel that the big book is the same way. We feel that the big book is a textbook. We feel that the big book is a book to be studied. We feel that it's almost impossible for we alcoholics to go to chapter 5 and do what chapter 5 says to do because we haven't laid the groundwork for it yet. And I hear people in AA, and I've been guilty of it, and it happened to me when I first came into the program, and they handed me the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said, take this book and go to chapter 5 and do what it says and everything will be all right. And I took this book and I went to chapter 5 and I looked at those steps and I tried to do what they said and everything wasn't all right. I went ahead and got drunk some more times. And after I got drunk some more times and I came back to the book and began to study the book, then I found that all the first part of the book leading up to chapter 5 lays the groundwork for chapter 5. And I think we have one of the greatest teaching aids, one of the greatest helps for the suffering alcoholic to be found in the doctor's opinion and the first four chapters of the big book. And we seem to fall in love with our own words and our own voices, and we seem to feel that we can explain these things better to the new man than the book itself can. And for my own personal use, and I'm sure Joe agrees with this too, I have found that the big book can explain alcoholism much, much better than I can if we can get people to read it. This is a textbook. It's a textbook that means we're going to have to study it. If we really want to get what the book has to say, if we really want to learn what is within the covers of the book, it's going to require a lot of time, a lot of effort, and a lot of study. Now, I think the second thing that we need to look at in the book is contained in the foreword to the first edition. In the foreword to the first edition, it says, we are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. And I think within this statement there's two things that we need to recognize. First, the thing says that we are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Usually when I read a book, and most books I read, they're authored by one person. And as I read that book and I read his statements and the great things that he has to say and his philosophy, if I don't like what he has to say, I simply tell myself, well, hell, I'm just as smart as he is. What makes him think he's right and I'm wrong? And I disregard what this guy has to say. Well, my big book tells me in the beginning of it, in the foreword to the first edition, that I'm not dealing with any one person. I'm not dealing with one author. I am dealing with more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. It says we are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. This book was put together by the first 100 people in Alcoholics Anonymous. This book was put together by these people after they had 4 years of experience in trying to get sober themselves and in trying to sober up other people. And as I read the book, and as I go through it and try to understand it, I always bear in mind that I am dealing with the collective knowledge and the collective experiences of the first 100 people in AA. And these first 100 people in AA have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. They have recovered from the same damn thing that's just eating me to death. And it's a little bit harder for me to argue with 100 people. When I see that there's 100 people recovered and this is the way that they do it, then I have to stop and think that if this works for 100 people, it may also work for me. And I think the second thing we need to look at contained in this first statement to the foreword to the first edition, it says to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Now, I hear a lot of people in AA, and again, I've been guilty of it too, that we deal with generalities. And I hear statements such as that these steps are but 12 suggested steps, and you don't have to take them if you don't want to. And I hear people say, well, the fourth step is just an inventory, and it really doesn't make any difference whether you write it or you take it in your head or you get up behind the podium and do it. I keep hearing statements such as, take what you would like to have and what you don't want, put up on the shelf and leave it. I keep hearing statements such as, you don't have to do anything at all that you don't want to in Alcoholics Anonymous. Just keep coming to the meetings and eventually this will rub off on you and everything will be all right. Now, I listened to those statements when I first came to AA, and I listened to them hard enough that I almost died from alcoholism. They have given us a statement in the beginning of the book which does not deal with generalities. The book says to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. Precisely means exactly. We're not dealing with general terms. They wrote the book to show other alcoholics exactly how they recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I think this is very, very important. Joe?
I'd like to move into the doctrine of opinion. This is one of my favorites. Charlie always leaves me the doctor's opinion because he knows how much this means to me. I think prior to Dr. Silkworth's work, and I think that AA members don't give this fine little doctor the great credit that he deserves. He was a very humble man. And as I studied the doctor's opinion and place it in the perspective that it should be, I see it's probably one of the greatest pieces of literature ever done in the field of alcoholism. This friend, little doctor, was, we talk about Bill and Dr. Bob. He was a very humble man, and he gave his life to the alcoholism. And it was he that opened the door for the work of Bill and Dr. Bob. You know, we were at this time that his work was done, we're right where we are with cancer today. Cancer is killing thousands of people in our society. And we're doing a lot of work, maybe not so much to find the cure of cancer, but the main purpose in the research is now going on is to find what is cancer. And we know this was a great breakthrough to Dr. Silkworth. Was Dr. Silkworth was the first person on the face of the earth to discover what was alcoholism. This one basic fact it lays the groundwork for the rest of the book. It is the most important part of the big book because without Dr. Silkworth's work, we would not have been able to develop the recovery program designed by Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the first thing you do to solve a problem is to find out the nature of it. What is the problem? And this is what Silkworth did. In his work, and I know before this time that there were many theories about alcoholism down through history. No one had ever even put it in the right category it was. Some people say it was physical. Some people say it was mental or emotional. Some people say it was weak will. And then we got a lot of preachers come along, crowded up. They say it was a sin. We couldn't ever even put it in a category in which it could function. But Dr. Silkworth, in his work, he began to tell us that the great discovery, you know, at this time and even in today, we have two great worlds that we live in. We have the world of medical physicians, and we have the psychiatric world, the world of mental health. And quite naturally, they pulled on the alcoholics for years. Some said it was medical, some said it was mental. And I think this one single factor that Dr. Silkworth discovered, he says it was half and half. And this is a great breakthrough he had when he sat down with Bill and explained to him the first time. And it seems like to me that it's such a great thing, and you can tell it's so humble that although it is the greatest piece of literature in the field of alcoholism, it was not published in the medical journal, but it was published in the original portion, the original copy of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was published with such a humble title. Such a great piece of work is still called the doctor's opinion. But in getting to the doctor's opinion, and when he gave us this great work, he says that we talk about the body of the alcoholic is quite as normal as his mind. It does not satisfy us to be told we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, or were in full flight from the reality of our outright mental defects. These things are true to some extent, in fact, to considerably stick to some of us. But we are sure that our bodies are sickened as well as our minds. It's our belief any picture of the alcoholic which leaves out his physical factors is incomplete. And sometimes I think that we don't talk very often about the physical part of alcoholism. Now, as Charlie said, this book is the basic ideas of the first 100 people that stayed sober. And we were talking today about the inability to transfer ideas with words. This is all that we have. We have words. Words sometimes is our only means of communicating. But we're going to have to stay sober on the basic ideas and not actually words, because sometimes the word does not convey the idea. And he goes on to over here, and he talks further. We believe, as so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcoholics on these alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy. And I know that in this word allergy, I know that all of us can use these words in our daily language, and I know that I did, but I really didn't have a nitty-gritty idea of what this doctor was talking about. And we learned that the word allergy means a reaction to a food or a substance that is different from normal, or an abnormal reaction to a food or a substance. And I used to always say an allergy was a bad reaction, but I found out it is not a bad reaction, it is an abnormal reaction, which is different. And we learned that alcohol is taken into the body, it has to be metabolized by the body, or processed by the body. It's a drug that is dangerous to the body, the body doesn't like it. So once the alcohol is induced to the system, there's certain enzymes or chemistry produced by the liver and the pancreas to attack the alcohol and eliminate it from the system. And the figures show that 9 out of 10 people in this country do this successfully. When alcohol is introduced to the system, certain these enzymes produced by the pancreas and the liver are introduced into the bloodstream and break the alcohol down from alcohol diacetic acid down to the acetones, and from the acetones down into water, carbon dioxide, and simple sugar. It's simply no very harmless process for most people. And then there's one person in this group of 10 that takes alcohol in his system, and for some reason or another, which we don't know, his pancreas and liver fail to produce the enzymes to break down the alcohol in sufficient quantity of quality. And when they attack the alcohol, they break it out to the diacetic acid and they leave it at the acetone level. And when this substance is in the system, this person handles alcohol different from the larger group of people. He does not break it down to its lowest terms. So when this person handles alcohol different from the larger group of people, he has an allergy. And it's this particular chemical, when it's in the system, that produces a craving for alcohol. A craving for alcohol by the chemistry of the body. And so the doctor said it, and he is a doctor, and Charlie and I get, you know, sometimes doctors don't say things too plain, particularly for people like me. So I had to go through all the explanation to say the doctor, we believe that it's so suggestive, bro, that the manifestation, just that the action of alcoholics on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of our allergy, and that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. These allergy types can never use alcohol in any form. And once having formed their habit and found they cannot break it, once having lost their self-consciousness, they arrive upon human things, their problems pile up upon them, and they become astonishingly difficult to solve. So he begins to say that this craving is caused from a body chemistry, an allergy. And then we learn that he talks about the mental side of this problem, or the mental or emotional side. That in our makeup, somewhere along the line, of these little mild adjustments we have, somewhere along the line we discover alcohol. And once we, somewhere along the line, as we have one of these little emotional upheavals, we reach up and get a drink. And we know that alcohol is a depressive drug, and it depresses this little thing that we have going on. It's a very subtle thing that takes place, and it did in my life. And I have a great memory bank, too. I have the ability to have problems, and I sometimes I solve them. And once I solve a problem, I have a memory bank. I remember what I did. And the next time I have that same problem, I just reach over and get the same solution. And once a person has a weird instincts, we have problems and find solutions, they repeat them. When we repeat them often enough, we add them together. And to me, that becomes addiction. And I didn't know I was doing it. So this was a problem of the mind. I'd have a problem and it builds up to certain points and my tolerance level. My tolerance level would trigger what the doctor talks about, this great word, obsession. We learn the word obsession is an idea that overcomes all our ideas and the mind will not retain but one predominant thought at a time. And once I triggered this obsession to drink, the idea to drink, I reached over and I got one drink. And once I took one drink, it set off the allergy of my body, which produces a craving, which produced a second drink. So I have two problems, and this is the first time that this thing was discovered and explained. And the doctor showed us that I have an obsession of the mind, which is the triggering mechanism for my allergy of the body. And I think that Dr. Shuttlesworth's work, to me, he was what Salk was to polio. He was one of the, and sometimes we, in talking about him, we don't give him the credit that he justly deserves. Because if he hadn't discovered this theory, and it was a theory at that time, it was not accepted by the American Medical Association, American Psychiatric Association in 1956. He was a person that led, that opened the doors. He discovered the lock that had trapped men down through the thousands of years. Charlie?
Yeah, like Joe, I'm always interested very deeply in the doctor's opinion because I think this is the basis for all successful alcoholism treatment programs today. And I like to read a little bit from the doctor's opinion in talking about the allergy to alcohol and it's Roman numeral page 28 in the big book. Dr. Shuttlesworth tells me in the big book that the classification of alcoholics seems most difficult and in much detail is outside the scope of this book. There are, of course, the psychopaths who are emotionally unstable. We're all familiar with this type. They are always going on the wagon for keeps. They are over-remorseful and make many resolutions but never a decision. There is a type of man who is unwilling to admit that he cannot take a drink. He plans various ways of drinking. He changes his brand or his environment. There is the type who always believes that after being entirely free from alcohol for a period of time, he can take a drink without danger. There is the manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written. Then there are types entirely normal in every respect except in the effect alcohol has upon them. They are often able, intelligent, friendly people. And Dr. Shuttlesworth says that all these and many others have one symptom in common, that they cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. This phenomenon, as we have suggested, may be the manifestation of an allergy which differentiates these people, and sets them apart as a distinct entity. It has never been, by any treatment with which we are familiar, permanently eradicated. The only relief we have to offer or suggest is entire abstinence. Now, Dr. Shuttlesworth has named for us here five different types of alcoholics. And we've got all different types of alcoholics. You know, some of us, we drink, we become very friendly, very lovable, very laughable, happy people. Some of us, when we drink, we become very sad and we become very depressed. Some of us, when we drink, we become meaner than hell. Some of us, when we drink, we become very sexy and we get to chasing these women. And we do many different things whenever we drink, and we drink many different types of alcohol, and we drink in many different ways, but all of us have one symptom in common. And that symptom that we have in common is that we cannot take a drink of alcohol without the phenomenon of craving that develops and makes it virtually impossible for us to stop drinking. Now, as Joe says, medical science today has almost proven this theory of Dr. Shuttlesworth. Well, I've got to remember in 1939, medical science didn't know about the liver, and it didn't know about the enzymes, and it didn't know about the acetic acid and the acetone and the etc.
And Dr. Silkworth was the first person to come up with the idea that the alcoholic's body is different from other people. That whenever he takes a drink, it sets off the phenomenon of craving, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop drinking after he once starts. Now, Dr. Silkworth also not only identifies the fact that I have an allergy to alcohol, that the phenomenon of craving develops when I take the first drink, that the abnormal reaction occurs, Dr. Silkworth also tells me why I like to drink this alcohol. And at the bottom of page 26, Roman numeral 26, Dr. Silkworth says that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. That the sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. Drinks which they see others taking with impunity. And after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. And this is repeated over and over, and unless this person can experience an entire psychic change, there is very little hope of his recovery. On the other hand, and strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. Now what's he said? What he has really said is that whenever I'm sober, I'm restless and I'm irritable and I'm discontented. And I like to add a few more words on, too. I'm full of shame, I'm full of guilt, and I'm full of remorse over the things that I do during my drinking sprees. I'm full of anger, and I'm full of fear, and I'm full of resentments, and I'm full of jealousies, and I just don't feel worth a damn. And I found out a long time ago that whenever I took a drink of alcohol, that all these feelings disappeared. And Dr. Silkworth says that the reason I'm drinking this alcohol is not because I like the taste of it. That I'm drinking this alcohol because I like the effect that's produced whenever I take a drink. And he tells me that being restless and irritable and discontented whenever I'm sober, that sure enough the time will come where I will seek the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And he tells me after I take those few drinks and the phenomenon of craving develops, that I'm going to pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. And I look back over my life and my last 10 years of drinking, and he thinned me to a T. Because I would run around and I would be sober. I'd quit drinking and I'd put the jug up on the shelf and I'd say, that's it, I'm never going to take another drink of that stuff. It makes me sick, it gets me in jail, it puts me in hospitals, it causes divorces. I'm through with it, I don't want more of it. And I really meant that I was going to quit drinking. But I'd be running around sober and I'd be so restless and so irritable and so discontented. And things wouldn't be going right, and my wife would be giving me a hard time, and the banker was wanting the money, and the guys on the job, they wasn't doing the way I thought they ought to, and my children wasn't doing things right, and I didn't feel good, and my mind would remember the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. And I'd take that drink, and the phenomenon of craving would develop, and it would be virtually impossible for me to stop drinking, and I would pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution never to take another drink. And I repeated this cycle over and over and over and over and over again. Now, what I like to look at right here is that Dr. Silkworth has told me here there is a way out of this. He says, I will do this over and over and over again, unless I can experience an entire psychic change. And he says, once the psychic change has occurred, then I will find it easily able to control my desire for alcohol. This is my first glimmering of hope in the big book as to a possible solution to my problem. He has got me hooked. He's made me think. And I'm saying to myself as I read this, well, what is this psychic change? If the psychic change will control the desire for alcohol, then maybe I ought to have one. And I'm an intellectual alcoholic. I have to go to the dictionary to look things up. And I looked up the word psychic. And I find that psychic deals with mind. And I find that what Dr. Silkworth is talking about here is that I'm going to have a change in my mental attitudes. That I'm going to have a change in my outlook upon life. That I'm going to have to take old ideas and old concepts and get rid of them and replace them with new ones. And he says, if I can do that, then I will find it easily able to control the desire for alcohol. He alerted me to two things. One, I have an allergy of the body. That whenever I take a drink, it's impossible for me to stop after I've once started. Two, I have an obsession of the mind that causes me to keep trying to drink this alcohol whenever my body won't let me do it. And that if I want to do anything about it, it's going to take a psychic change. And when I reached this point in the big book, I very desperately began to try to find out what is this psychic change that Dr. Silkworth talks about. It's how Dr. Silkworth, as we say, gave us this great discovery. He was the first person to show us what the problem was, and we saw then ways could be designed to attack it. He discovered, and he stared at this lock because as he talked with Bill. So it was a great medical man, a medical doctor, that gave us the basic information for the whole book. And later on in our discussion, I hope tonight, we're going to bring in another medical person, and we're going to show you what a key part that we feel like that he played in this great thing, because he was the guy actually that discovered the key that opened this lock. But I think, I like the way he closes it. I always think about Silkworth. I earnestly advise everybody to read this book through and through. Perhaps even he came to scoff, he may remain to pray. And I think that his work in the front of the book, and so many, many times, is the basis of the whole book, because it's on Dr. Silkworth's concept in which we were able to find out how to attack and how to bring about this psychic change so that we can quickly recover from alcoholism. As I say today, and right today, I still have the allergy to alcohol. I always like to say that I'm 15 years older than I was since I had my last drink, and my body produces less of the chemicals to break down alcohol, so actually, you know, my allergy is worse. When I no longer have, you know, the triggering mechanisms that made my alcoholism active through the tubes of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Next thing, we get into Bill's story, and I think it is, I love Bill's story. I hear the people around AA that don't like drunkologues, and I think it's one of the prettiest drunkologues I've ever read, and it's necessary. You know, the first thing before you get into in this book that I had to identify with the author, and that we had some similarities, some basis of which we're going to communicate. And I had to identify with Bill as I began to read in this story about the things that begin to take place in Bill's life. Now, I had a lot of things that similar in different places and different situations that happened to Bill, and it is a drunkologue, yeah. And it's there for a purpose for me to identify with the author of the work as to some point of acceptance as I went on. So I basically think that I'm reading Bill's story, and one half of this story, we will confine actually that Bill was in a very precarious position. And one half of this book, Bill was powerless over alcohol, and his life was unmanageable. And another half of this book, you know, it's on about the way up. Another half of Bill's story is simply, you could read this whole chapter, and if you had to make a consensus of what he's saying, it's actually saying that Bill was powerless over alcohol, his life was unmanageable. And then he came to believe in a power greater than himself, and he went on the way up. Actually, it describes the way down and the way up. And basically, I think these two ideas are accomplishing the first two steps of the book. And this is where we identify from the author and the possibilities of finding the solution. And I think that this is basically what the first chapter is all about.
any great ideas.
Remember that we said in the beginning that one of the three main purposes of the book was to identify the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Silkworth identifies the problem medical-wise, and Bill's story is placed in here for us to identify with one of these first 100 people who recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I know that many people in AA today feel that they're unable to identify with Bill. But I think any alcoholic who will read Bill's story and read it thoroughly will find certain areas that he can definitely identify with. Now, Bill was a New York stockbroker, and certainly my occupation is not a New York stockbroker. I can't identify with him as far as his occupation was concerned. But I can sure identify in Bill's story with the hopelessness that he felt every time he came out of the hospital and he went back out on the streets and he had sworn that he would never take another drink. And after a period of time, his mind would become confused and things wouldn't go right, and he would think, well, one more time I'll be able to take a drink. This time I can take it and get by with it. And Bill would take the drink and he would get drunk and he would get sick and he would end up back in the hospitals again. I can certainly identify in Bill's story when he talked about stealing money from his wife's purse in order to have enough money to buy booze on. And I can certainly identify with Bill when he talks about the hopelessness and the desperation that he felt one night, and he was so afraid that he would throw himself through a second-story window that he took the mattress off the bed and drug it downstairs and laid it in the floor because he was afraid he'd jump out the second-story window. I can identify with Bill when he talked about his good-natured contempt and his grandfather's good-natured contempt of people that went to church. And then he had a kind of a laughable idea about these church-going, praying people were weak people. Bill's story is put in here also for identification. Dr. Silkworth identified the problem of alcoholism. Bill's story is put in here for us to read and see and know that here is a man that is like I am. Here is a man that's had the same feelings and the same thoughts and the same ideas. Here is a man who's had the same problems and the same desperation. And it's put in there for me to see that this man not only had all these troubles, but this man found a way out. That this man found a way to recover from alcoholism. And Bill's story is placed in here in the beginning of the book to give me hope. To give me hope. And as I read Bill's story in the book, I found that Bill had a great spiritual experience. And I found that the old ideas that Bill once held so dear were cast aside and they were replaced with a new set of ideas. I began to tie this together with the fact that Dr. Silkworth talked about a psychic change. Bill talks about a spiritual experience. And here is where I got the first glimmering of maybe this psychic change, maybe this mental attitude that they're talking about does have to have something to do with a spiritual experience. Now, I didn't like it. And I didn't like the thought that I may have to have the damn spiritual experience that Bill had, but nevertheless, it was there. And again, Bill's story is for the purpose of identification. To identify with us as alcoholics and to show us that there is a way to recover from alcoholism. Put in the perfect place with the perfect sequence to go along with Dr. Silkworth's opinion.
Later on, before tonight's show, we'll get into the structure of the what the first doc's opinion of the first step is doing. And we move to chapter 2. There is a solution. I identify this so much with the second step of our wonderful program. And I think that in the first page of this beautiful chapter, which is one of my favorites, we of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. He's going back to tie you in with the first chapter. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved their drink problem. Then he gives us our first hope, our first glimmering of what our solution can be. He says, we are average Americans. All sections of this country, many occupations, are represented as well as many political, economical, and social and religious backgrounds. This is true, and surely as we sit here tonight, there are many occupations here tonight. There are many political, economical, and social-religious background. This is a strange conglomeration of people, different races, strange group of people here in this room. Just a bunch of weird folks. Have nothing, you know, it's strange. No one here tonight. And I know it's really shaking. No one here tonight should have never known the other. Should have never known the other. We are normally people who should not mix. We have nothing in common. But there exists among us, amongst these strange group of people, a fellowship and a friendliness that is indescribably wonderful. Hard boss. And he explains why. We are like the passengers on the great liner the moment after the shipwreck, Canary William Jaw and Democracy purveyed the vessel from the stairs to the captain's table. And we can see that he using illustrations of his time, because during his time the way to travel to Europe was on the great liners. And I often see the Titanic for some reason, I guess because it sticks in my mind. And we see the fellow from the captain's table, from the highest of the highest, and the richest of the richest was on the top decks dancing and before the catastrophe. He had nothing in common with the man in the steward sections, and we have to learn a lot about the steward section was literally the bottom of this liner. This man couldn't even come out for air. But once the disaster occurred, they will say they were both hanging in the water, and they were rescued. And the moment after they were rescued, there was Democracy, and then they were together. There was a oneness, and they hugged each other, and they celebrated. But unlike the ship's passengers, however, our joy does not escape from disaster, does not subside as we go our individual ways, because surely these two people would go back to their lifestyles and have nothing in common. And he says the feeling of having shared the common peril is the one element in this powerful cement that binds us. And we know tonight if we discuss groups of people, we can discuss family ties. They have the same blood relations. This brings them together. We have people that are bound together by causes such as a union. That binds them together. We have people that are bound by creeds, mottos, and even beliefs. That brings people together in groups. There are many different things that bind people. But my author is telling me that the suffering is one of the greatest bonds. You know, it's the same thing that the children of Israel had. It's the same thing that the people had in concentration camps in Germany. It's the same thing that our forefathers had that formed this great country that we live in. They suffered on a common problem and it brought them close together. And he said, this is one element in the powerful cement that binds us. And I think that to me, I think it's the first solution in Alcoholics Anonymous, is the fellowship. And I know myself, when I came into this program, I got in there and that was the first thing I liked, that fellowship. Man, I like that coffee and smoke them cigarettes and make you feel good and this. That's all I did. I didn't, you know, they had them 12 steps and all that other stuff. But I think it's a great umbrella of protection that goes over the new alcoholic is fellowship. Now this is not good sobriety, but this is only the beginning. And he said, this is the first bond. And I'm sure tonight that some of us, if you and you have that bond. And if you have this other bond, then he goes very uniquely into the second bond. But that itself would have never held us as we are now joined. Then he gives us a second bond. The tremendous fact. For every one of us is we have found a common solution. So I not only have the bond of a common suffering, but Sally and I also have a bond of a common solution. And I think this is the first solution to this problem of Alcoholics Anonymous is the fellowship. It offers a certain amount, it offers a beginning.
I thought about this a lot today. On the way over here, when this thing that says we're average Americans in all sections of this country and many of its occupations are represented, as well as many political, economic, social, and religious backgrounds, and we are people who normally would not mix. And Joe came up to my house last night, you know, and I'm a white man and Joe's a black man, And we started on the way down here today, and we went by Tulsa, and damned if we didn't pick up a Mexican and brought him with us, too. I'm sitting here tonight thinking, I'm sorry we didn't come by Anadarko and get us an Indian and bring him along with us, too. We are people who normally would not meet us. But we are joined together by a common peril. We have all shared the common peril of alcoholism. And I think here, within these words, on the first page of chapter 2, is the first warning in the big book. It says, the feeling of having shared in the common peril is one element in the powerful cement which binds us together. But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The fellowship of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is an indescribably wonderful thing. But that by itself is not enough. The great fact is that we have found a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news that this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. And the fellowship of AA is a great thing. And I see too many people in AA who are going to the meetings and enjoying the fellowship and drinking the coffee and smoking the cigarettes and peeing a lot and telling stories and laughing and having fun. And they're taking a part in the fellowship of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but too many of them are not doing anything about the common solution. And my book tells me that this fellowship alone is not enough. That if I want to recover from alcoholism, I need to also be looking at the common solution. I have one more statement in the book here I'd like to handle in chapter 2 before we get too far into it, and this is on page 20. And on page 20, still dealing in chapter 2, there is a solution. It says, you may already have asked yourself why it is that all of us became so very ill from drinking. Doubtless you are curious to discover how and why, in the face of expert opinion to the contrary, we have recovered from a hopeless condition of mind and body. If you're an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? It is the purpose of this book to answer such questions specifically. We shall tell you what we have done. We're not dealing in generalities. The purpose of this book is to answer these questions for us specifically. They will tell us exactly what they have done. 100 people taking their time, taking the effort, taking the work, using everything that they've got to put it down in printed form, exactly what they have done. They will tell me specifically if I will only listen.
I think it's worthwhile mentioning, I think down at the bottom of page 20, he gives us in great detail the three ways that in case we're trying to find out a searching alcohol can be used by an individual. Modern drinking, and sometimes we refer to it as social drinking, he relates to that. Then he says a certain type of hard drinker, and it relates to hard drinking, and I like to call us a drunk. And then he says alcoholism, which he explains in great detail. And I think that any man, woman, child will fit under one of these areas. Modern drinker, hard drinker, or alcoholism. And so I think that this is a great instrument in the book. Later on, he really gets down to the solution further over on page 25. There is a solution. Finally, he begins to mention it deep within the solution chapter. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings which this process requires for a successful consummation. But we saw that it really worked in others, and we had come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of life as we had been living it. When therefore we were approached by those in whom the problem had been solved, we were nothing left but to pick up a simple kit of spiritual tools which laid at our feet. We found much of heaven and have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence which we have not even dreamed. The great fact is this, and nothing less, that we have had a deep and effective spiritual experience. And this spiritual experience, it has revolutionized our whole attitude toward life toward our fellows and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today, he's getting right down to it now, is an absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has accomplished those things for us we could not do by ourselves. And I think that one of the most important things in this chapter and in this book, and if you'll notice, there's a little asterisk there. And I get kind of confused sometimes, and I think most people don't pay too much attention to these things, but I think we have to, as Charlie said, be pretty precise here. And this little asterisk here, we have to turn back to page 569, because he's saying that a spiritual experience is what's going to make this change. And then he saw fit later to, on page 569, to put a section in our book which says fully explained appendix 2. And if you turn back to 569, you will find appendix 2, which will give you in great detail what this spiritual experience is and how it might occur. And I see how you could actually grasp that idea if you would overlook appendix 2 in the back of the book. Now, it's not, as we say around Little Rock and there in Arkansas, we are kind of a dumb people. And I say you have to be very careful in this book, because we always say a Yankee drunk wrote it, and it's kind of hard to figure out. But you have to be real careful and just follow him, you know, in the great detail in what he does. And he talks about this term, spiritual experience and spiritual awakening, I use many times in this book. Which, upon careful reading, shows that the personality change is sufficient, good enough to recover from alcoholism, has manifested itself in us in many different forms. In the first printing, a lot of people read Bill's story, it says here. And in reading Bill's story, they got the impression that they saw Bill's sudden change. And they thought that in order to recover, that they had to have a similar experience. I had a problem with this. Bill had a sudden spiritual experience. Now, in our first few chapters,